now is sort of a situation where you're saying that it was right to remove Saddam Hussein because he killed a lot of his people and he intended to develop weapons of mass destruction. Based on that rationale, what other nations are at risk of having the same sort of action taken against them based on this new Bush doctrine?
I don't know of any other nation that we believe a point has been reached with that requires preemptive action of any kind. And as I mentioned earlier, we're using diplomatic efforts. Military action is not our first choice. It is not something we immediately go to. The president has been very clear about this. And in the case of Iraq, we took it to the UN. In the case of Libya, we work with our British colleagues. In Iran, we're working with the IAEA, and we're working with the European Union ministers who have been designated to work on this, three ministers. And in North Korea, we're working with our friends. In the case of Iraq, the intelligence community and its best judgment was that they had stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, in addition to the capability to develop them, and an intention to have them. And there's no question about an intention and capability, but the intelligence community did not get it right, apparently, with respect to stockpiles. We haven't found them yet, and they're still looking, but I do not expect to see huge stockpiles found. But if that was the error, it's an error in the...
Shut the hell up, colon cancer pal. This rhetoric about you don't know any other nations where you were going to have to use a preemptive strike and act out on it. Look, that's all you've been doing for a generation. Actually, that's what you've been doing since the history of this country. The Native Americans, preemptive strike. The conquest of the Africans. Preemptive strike. The attack against Cuba at the Bay of Pigs was an attempted preemptive strike. Panama, preemptive strike. Guatemala, preemptive strike. Nicaragua, preemptive strike. It's time that the empire gets struck back. And this rhetoric about our intelligence community said that there was a stockpile of weapons of mass destruction. Well, Hans Blix, Scott Ritter, and hordes of other people who weren't fabricating this so-called evidence with you knew better. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, the world, and radioforall.net, the universe, slave revolt radio time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment as we're going to deal with what is happening to the environment in the hands of the capitalists. And then we're going to go down that yellow brick road of corrosion and check out in a commentary how McDonald's is playing the same role in every way you can imagine. And then Gerald wrap it up on the Making It Plain news. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more. 104.1 Slave Revolt. Thank you.
walls, broken down elevators, urine stench in the halls. Yoked in oppression membrane, four locks and three chains to bar them out. Or to bar me in. Wealth. For a little blow off the pipe, we line massive pockets, bought and sold on Wall Street with bonds of stock market. This is not my nation, where riots burn in the streets, where killers are disguised as officers. Could you look downtown, shouting, no justice, no peace? How about for food? Or for shoes for your kids' feet? Oh, man, my fault. That's reserved for NBA repeats. This is certainly not my language, not my clothing, nor my customs. Seeking, not
seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Tonight, what we're going to deal with is, in this corroded society, the shuck and jive process of many sorry Americanos in this populace on issues of how white supremacy works within this capitalist order. How the gender game is played out, and the role of denial that liberals, conservatives, many of these progressives and so-called radical types play into this, is a situation where many people have been able to tap dance with blinders on through the minefield. But when it concerns what is happening to the ecosystem, at least the sustainable one, on this planet, there's no tap dancing around this issue. See, it's one thing to pretend that racism in America doesn't exist anymore. But this type of process that many people have played in honestly addressing these issues and how both parties play a role in corroding people's analysis on these issues is, in essence, connected to how many people are not seeing the urgency of what is happening to our eco-environment on a global scale. We're going to deal with that and connect some dots. You know, Marg Barlow, she's a co-writer of a recent book out called Blue Gold. It deals with water in particular. And she outlines some of the things that have been put out by David Suzuki on the water crisis and how things may appear to look a-okay at one particular time, the day before it collapses, and then lo and behold, you're in a whole nother situation that you never thought or imagined you would be in. So first, let's check out what Barlow has to say, and then we'll take it from there. So check this out.
He tries to explain what exponential destruction of the environment is. And he said if we could see it, if it was linear, so if 1 plus 1 and then 2 plus 2, you could kind of see something coming at you. But when exponential destruction of the environment takes place, it's taking place, nobody can see it all. It's taking place in so many points. And he says the day before it's all gone, it might look just fine. To explain that, he says, look, there's a lake or a pond and lily pads on it. Now it's fine. A lake can survive with lily pads, but not if it's totally covered. Because if they totally cover it, oxygen will be cut off. So he says, if it were linear, you could count them and you'd know when you're in trouble. But he says, with exponential destruction or exponential growth of these, he said, this lake is going to be covered with lily pads in 60 days. Now, what does it look like on day 59? Well, with exponential growth, 4 times 4, 8 times 8, 16 times 16, it's only half full the day before it's dead. And I think, you know, and I quote him, and I know him quite well, and I know he does think this, that he would look at the water crisis in the world now and say, it looks like we have lost. Certainly you can walk down the streets of New York or any other city, and major city in North America, and you buy all the bottled water you have, and it might be raining, or you go to places where there's still a lot of lakes, and you think, what are we talking about? There's lots of water left. In fact, by that analogy, you may be on day 59 in terms of how much water we have. It's the twin crises of pollution on one hand. Almost half of the world's population has no access to sanitation. A child dies every 8 seconds of polluted water, waterborne diseases, as we speak in this world. So there's the twin problems of pollution on one side, but actual physical water scarcity, taking good water where it belongs, using it in ways that destroys it, or allowing, and the aquifers are now finding through mining or through careless use of aquifers, they're allowing saltwater intrusion. So it's actually taking water that's fresh now and either polluting it or converting it to salt water. So we're actually diminishing the amount of available fresh water as we add, 85 million people every year to the planet. So it's the combination of overuse, pollution, and total and complete disregard for something that is finite. There's nowhere to go to get more of this.
Now, what's interesting about, in part, what she's saying is that, we've seen some of the eco-collapse, and the beginnings of eco-collapses of major river arteries in this country, where the Mississippi has a dead zone thousands of feet long now, and it's completely oxygenated. The dead zone just floats around, and any fish or living life that gets caught within this blob of a dead zone perishes. Now, if the Mississippi River ends up collapsing and turns into a completely dead sea, the ramifications of that would be astronomical, because it wouldn't just affect the living species in the Mississippi, but the surrounding plant life, tree life, and the ecosystem as a whole, you know, birds and other animals that lives are necessitated off of a healthy river basin. Now, we've already seen the beginning signs of the Mississippi's serious deterioration, and there's not really even a blink of an eye. At the same time, there's been a number of books out lately by various authors who are signing or ringing the alarm bells about what is going on in the ocean itself, where giant clouds are floating over down by India over into the ocean, and the sunlight is not able to penetrate because of the giant death clouds, and is messing up the photosynthesis. A number of fish species themselves have been overfished, like codfish, the bluefin tuna. Recently in Japan, one bluefin tuna sold for over $140,000. Because, see, in the way the market capital system works, it's obvious there's a major decline. So in a sane society, you would want to preserve and hope that you can help rebuild that particular population that has been overfished. But in the capital market system, the less fish, the more valuable that fish is. So as the fish population of the blue tuna is crashing, the fishermen are going after the fish more and more aggressively, running it right into the hands of the shadow of extinction. This is the way this whole market system is driving the water and other organisms that are based in the water, which in essence means life on this planet.
Absolutely. You know what? If this brings to mind immediately when we're talking about, since we're talking about the environment, remember what just happened when Mr. Bush came to office. The first thing that I remember is they tried to talk their way out of the Kyoto Treaty. That is the treaty in which many, many countries were going to try to cooperate against the greenhouse effect, see, against global warming. And the way to do that would be to reduce the amount of emissions. Well, they've done a recent investigation into the use of science by the Bush administration, and this study alleges a systematic pattern of suppressing or distorting scientific evidence across a wide range of issues. This study was done by the Union of Concerned Scientists in the year 2004. Now, you know, one might say, okay, Bush decides he's not, you know, he's going to opt out as the chief executive for the United States. Why lie? Well, he can't just opt out and not say anything. They have to try to produce some semblance of a rational reason that they chose to opt out. And this leads to denial of the greenhouse effect. You understand? And so in global warming. And in effect, what you wind up with is pseudoscience being advocated by the government to justify its political policies. Specifically, the report charges that there is a well-established pattern of suppression and distortion of scientific findings by high-ranking Bush administration political appointees in many federal agencies, a wide-ranging effort to manipulate the government's scientific advisory system, and censorship on topics deemed sensitive to the administration's political base. Now, I want to say that such, while people say that it's unprecedented because they're looking at the present regime, the objective knowledge is being distorted for political ends by the Bush administration and misrepresented or even withheld from Congress and the public at large. This is not the beginning of this process. Capitalism, as a system that seeks to maximize the bottom line, often finds itself in conflict with science.
All right, now next up, Barlow talks about the water privatization scenario that's going on and its particular effect. So let's see what she has to say. Check this out.
Well, one of the aspects of privatization, of course, is the move to privatize your water delivery. And interestingly, a lot of privatizations started in North America, particularly the United States. The privatization of water started in Europe with two great big huge French companies called Vivendi and Suez. It was Suez Lyonnais des Eaux. They've just changed to Suez. Vivendi, if Americans know Vivendi now, they know it as a big company that's moving into telecommunications. But its main original function was water, and that's still the biggest division of its empire, and it still pays for everything. Its water division is paying for its intrusion into Hollywood and buying every station that you know about here and there. So Vivendi and Suez, between them, there are 10 huge water companies, but those are the two biggest ones in terms of the delivery of water. And they have got the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund on their side promoting water privatization throughout the Third World. So much as 10, 15 years ago, the World Bank and the IMF were promoting privatized health care or education. We all know those stories through structural adjustment programs in the Third World. Now it's water privatization. And the stories are just appalling. I mean, basically, the company gets a contract where, by and large, they're guaranteed profits no matter whether a profit is turned or not. We have well documented in there, both from Great Britain and France and South Africa and Latin America and many places that these companies have moved into, you get higher water prices, you get less good water quality, you get huge earnings for these CEOs, because you take something that's been a public service and not for profit, delivered to people because they need it, and you turn it into something that goes for full cost pricing, which is what they're basing this on. You basically have untold ability to make money. I mean, this is blue gold. This stuff people will pay any amount of money for. So that's one level of privatization.
All right, now, as you heard Barlow talk, you know, the reason why, you know, you often hear me just slap around the Democrats and stuff like that, and those people who get into this lesser of two evil claptrap stuff, as you heard, the whole privatization of water taking place worldwide is tied in to the whole economic capital order, the IMF, the World Bank, them imposing structural adjustments on the third world. The countries have to guarantee that these corporations make a profit. So they have a guaranteed profit built in, whether they're throwing you out sludge at the end of the day or not, which they are. The water quality is shown to be worse. People who don't have access to water or the money to now buy the privatized water, they're just ass out, i.e. expendable. This is all part of the market order. And this is as deeply rooted into the soullessness of John Kerry as it is in Boy George. They maintain this order, and there's no way that either one of them being elected into office will not have the same type of global impact on the masses of people throughout the world, and help set up the conditions for the next wars to be consolidated in. This whole thing is a sham when you look at this whole process. There are many corporations foreseeing future water wars. And their whole privatization process, which means there's some winners and there's some losers. In the same way the food bracket goes, we have a world that produces more than enough food to feed the world. But that is not the point. It's not the capacity that is available. It's the fact of, do you have the material economic means to have access to it? And if you happen to live in a particular environment or country that's being exploited, or has been forced to make cocoa, you know, coffee, instead of what your country had initially been doing for hundreds, maybe even thousands of years, in a form of sustainability, and you are then thrust into a market order where you have to compete. Your cocoa has to compete with other, marketeers that are, you know, into this whole game, and they download your price. So where you don't really get any real bang off the buck, so to speak, then you're ass out, and your people are going to starve. And that's all there's to it. That's in part what happened to Somalia years ago when they got caught up in that whole economic bracket where they were making everything except what the people needed to put in their stomachs, because they were in this whole global trade thing handcuffed by the particular capital order. So you have a situation where there's no way out if you believe in this capital system, and those who, of course, play the administrators for the ruling class, like the Democrats or Republicans.
You know, it's even worse than that when you look at what is the decline, and I hope collectively we can reverse this, and bring back the redemption and the renaissance of science. When you look at what they're doing now with this Bush regime, there's a certain, you know, you can see a larger pattern that ranges from the misuse of intelligence information to justify the war in Iraq, to deception about the budget, the economy, the effects of tax cuts, to the list just goes on. And in its length and its scope, it is unprecedented. Now, that's because Bush is a special case in that sense, more brazen. Some may object that such information is partisan and has no place in a discussion about science and no bearing on its mission of bringing our mission here, Slave Revolt, of bringing the truth to the people. But you see, in fact, that is exactly what's being attacked by capitalism. Scientific endeavor is the search for truth. And the corruption of politics and the corruption of leads to the corruption of science and public information for public ends, and it ought to be deeply offensive to any intelligent citizen. Allowed to continue, it will. Just like in the situation in the Soviet Union when they tried to impose scientific doctrine to, they tried to rather subordinate scientific doctrine to a party line, we saw the demoralization of the scientists, etc., and the discredit of the information that they came up with, even though they made enormous strides. And specifically for those working for conservation biology, as this lady is talking about, it means that research, whatever its merit or import, will be discounted or disregarded by federal agencies, the Congress, and the White House.
The reason why I don't really get in a lot of times into what's worse than and all of that is because in many ways it's kind of tied together. And it's clear that this basic looking at the world in an analytical, scientific way has more or less in America been thrown out. And what is often parlayed as politics in this society is a form of elitism, celebrityism, a la Arnold Schwarzenegger, consumerism, can you get yours, et cetera, et cetera. So this is all tied in to how Bechtel and a number of these other corporations are able to push their way through without a real debate in this society, because in many ways it's not a healthy society. So it's not to be surprising that a healthy, rational debate about what's going on in the ecosystem of the planet and how it is affecting and infecting the planet take place from grade school on up is basically cast aside and looked upon as some kind of dream world fantasy thought, doomsday thought, you know, or someone who wants to live in some kind of fantasy Luddite world. These types of cliché-ish sound bites have won over at this particular time over the masses who have been gumpified down not to look rationally at what's going on. Now, you know, in nearly every year since 1859, the total amount of oil, let's go into oil, extracted from the world's ancient and finite underground reserves has grown from a few thousand barrels a year to 65 million barrels per day by the end of the 20th century. So in 1859, around that time, we're taking a few thousands of barrels out a year. Now we're taking 65 million barrels out per day. Now, recently, you've seen a number of mergers that have taken place. You've seen Exxon and Mobil have combined to be Exxon Mobil, the world's largest oil company. Chevron has merged with Texaco. Conoco has merged with Phillips. And BP has purchased Arco. And even small and medium sizes such as Tosco, Valero, and others have merged together. And their divestments have totaled $82 billion in 1998 to over $50 billion in 1999. Now, while this on a certain level looks like, you know, this the regular modes of consolidation and, you know, this whole monopoly type thing, a Goldman Sachs put out a report in 1999 saying that, quote, "The oil companies are not going to keep rigs employed to drill dry holes. They know it, but are unable to admit it. The great merger mania is nothing more than a scaling down of a dying industry in recognition that 90% of the global conventional oil has already been found." Meanwhile, the Energy Information Agencies, the EIA, predicted that global demand for oil will continue to grow, increasing 60% by the year 2020 to roughly 40 billion barrels per day, of nearly 120 billion barrels per day. Now, what is they? Most scientists have said we have either reached the peak of all of the oil, of half of the oil that we have at our reserve, and from now on are going to be going down, and the oil is going to be harder and harder to find, or we're about to reach the peak. Now, in a rational world, alternative energy systems and other mechanisms would be deeply invested in. But in a capital market world, this is seen as an opportunity by large corporations to consolidate in some ways their power for war, mm-hmm. which is going to be the results, because you're going to have various entities, corporations, etc., nations trying to strangle other ones over a finite resource that is that will become harder and harder to get. Most of the oil that has been pumped out of the ground now is the oil that's most readily available.
Right.
It gets harder and harder from this time on, or soon to be from this time on. And the oil quality won't be as good. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning this is that large numbers of the water supply in this country and around the world have been contaminated. 40% of the water supply in rivers and so on and so forth in America have been contaminated, and the regulations maintaining a clean water system have been greatly reduced by Boy George and company. Now, of course, the way they've done this is to hold back the science on, you know, clean water and what, how many particles, if it's mercury and other things, should be allowed for people to use. But that's because it's part of an economic order. And without the masses of people in motion, well, hell, they're going to take everything. You know, the fact that the masses of people aren't using science in any way to critique anything going on around them, except for baseball statistics, of course they're going to whip that ass. And in essence, they whipping that ass and making sure that the future is going right with it. Now, next, Barlow talks about the madness of bottled water and the hunting of water that's taking place. Check this out.
There are several others. One is the bottling of water. Again, 10, 15 years ago, it was very rare to see a bottle of water. Now it's very rare not to. Bottled water has become very cool. While it's not cool, it's a form of mass insanity to let our public water systems deteriorate and to put water in boutique bottles to compete with each other all over the world. Last year, we put 84 billion liters of water in bottles. most of it plastic, most of it ending up in the rivers and streams and, you know, the meadows and the wetlands of the world. And that is, that's increasing again exponentially. 20% a year that business is growing. Now have companies that we call water hunters that are going into countries in Latin America, parts of the United States and Canada, looking for water, buying up water rights, buying up land in some areas just so that they can hold on to the water underneath the ground because they know it's going to be worth a fortune. You get companies like Nestle, which owns 68 of the big brand companies, including Perrier and San Pellegrino and lots of ones that you might think are these nice little bottle companies, you know, we all order in restaurants. They're scouring. They've got to fight back in the United States with people with the slogans, you know, go away Perrier and no way Perrier. I mean, these companies have become big transnational.
So as you heard Barlow talk about, here we have all of this bottling of water, which is basically reflective of the fact that most people don't trust the water that's out of their tap. But the reason why is because in many areas around the country, crud is coming out of their tap. They have manipulated through pseudoscience and basically firing scientists who try to speak out the various particles that are safe for people to drink, for kids to drink, for pregnant women to drink, etc., etc. And people can taste the difference in the water as years go by and have become concerned. But instead of fighting against an economic privatizing order that is manipulated, this is not just happening out of nowhere. This is a process that's going on through the whole deregulation, market drive of, you know, the Bechtel privatizers of the world. So in the same way that people have had to, put regulations on car industries because we have a society that allows, some privatized car companies. Well, as they privatize your water, you're going to have to put regulations on them. The reality is that in the same society, there would be no privatization of water. But the whole bottled water craze is a result of it. Now, instead of people addressing that aspect of what is happening to the water supply and how it's being corroded, people get caught up in this fashion consumerism of nice bottled water, which often doesn't even have any standard that it has to be better than the water
out
of your tap, you know, but it's just some kind of promotional gimmick that comes out. People buy into that and aren't critically examining what the hell is happening to the water. There used to be a joke years back about when you go to Mexico, don't drink the water. Now when you come to America, don't drink the water. And unfortunately, most people don't see the irony in that.
You know how serious that is? This is something that bugged me for years. Tracy, you remember when the gasoline companies came up with this tributylated methanol, which was supposedly going to make the air cleaner. It would burn cleaner, cause the gasoline to burn cleaner, and therefore we'd have fresher air and still get to use all the automobiles we want. Well, there was a problem with this tributylated methylene. And the problem was that because it had a water base, insofar as it leaked out of any of the worn-out tanks of the thousands of gas stations up and down the coast here in California, it worked its way into the water table. And, you know, it's something that you just said that was very important. You see, this water they give you, supposed to be, you think you cool drinking that water? Just recently, I have noticed some of the producers of this bottled water will put on that they have filtered out the following poisons. And tributylated methylene is one of them if you're in the state of California, because that's where we did that and ruined the water table here. Well, guess what? if they put it on one bottle and they claim they filtered it out, what do you think about the other bottles of water where they don't mention it? Just put one and one together now. I know you can figure this out. It is highly unlikely that if they don't forthrightly state that they have filtered it out, that they haven't. And therefore, you think you're drinking something better or more healthy, but all water comes from the water table. If they haven't filtered it out and cleaned it up, it's the same water coming out your tap. You've been took. You've been had. You've been bamboozled once again. And here is yet another way, you see, that they actually wind up giving you inferior products without regulation. Tracy.
All right, next up, Barlow talks about the privatizing domination of Bechtel. The privatizers of water out of, based out of San Francisco. So let's check out what she has to say.
What happened was the World Bank said to Bolivia, in the state of Cochabamba, we want you to privatize your water system, and they introduced them to Bechtel in a very aggressive way. Bechtel came in, and which is a big American engineering company, as you know, and they set up a water company, Aguas de Tenari. This water company immediately doubled the price of water, and there was a war. People literally said, we can't afford it. I mean, this is one of the poorest countries in Latin America, 75% indigenous. They could not afford the water. They took to the streets, the army was brought in, people were arrested in the middle of the night. I mean, it was a very bad thing. People were killed. But they stayed strong. Bechtel was forced to leave the country. The World Bank was furious. It put a very bad mark, if you will, on this World Bank process. Now Bechtel is suing the government of Bolivia for its lost future profits under what's called a bilateral investment treaty, which is very much like NAFTA. It's the same provisions under NAFTA that allows a corporation to sue the government of another country if it loses, if its profits are expropriated because of any law it brings in. And it moved its holding company from the Cayman Islands to Holland, because Holland had a bilateral investment agreement with Bolivia. So this is a very important demonstration of how these trade agreements work, because not only do you have the big agreements like the upcoming General Agreement on Trade and Services, the GATT, which is going to include water as a service, or the current NAFTA, which has water as a good and an investment, and now under the new Free Trade Area of the Americas, you're talking about bringing in water as a service. But you've got something like 1,700 bilateral agreements around the world. And these are agreements between countries, one-on-one, which gives corporations the rights to say to other to governments, can't bring in that piece of legislation because we'll sue you. And what they can do is that they can just move or open a subsidiary in any country with a bilateral agreement with the country in question.
All right, so what you see scandalously happening, when Bechtel went into Bolivia, as she Barlow was talking about, they doubled the price. The people threw them out. But now, through all of this, you know, World Bank, structural adjustment, GATT regulations and stuff, the people can be punished for throwing out a corporation
that's robbing them.
That is destroying the fabric of their particular lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the masses of people in this country where this corporation is running amok, and will be running amok, and is starting to run amok in your own backyard, hasn't blinked an eye. Now, one does not have to use too much mathematics or scientific thought to realize that doubling someone's cost for something like water in a poor country will have a devastating effect, especially when the product that you then release is not in any way superior to the product that was coming out beforehand. This is just basically a manipulation and control over an essential resource of human beings for their basic existence. They know that you can do without a TV, but you can't do without water. So they're just going right to you and basically taking your heart right out of your body, dryly. Now, next, Barlow talks about what corporate power is being gained under GATT. So let's check out what she has to say.
What's going to happen under the GATT? Under the WTO, yet, at this point, they still can't force privatization. That's been more the way the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have operated. However, what's happening in Geneva as we speak is the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which is being negotiated. By the end of June this year, every country is going to have to tell every other country which services it wants that country to open up. And we just got, in another brown paper bag, we get a lot of these, the demands from the European Union of Canada and the United States, and water privatization is one of the key demands from the European Commission of Canada and the United States. So the process is kind of like a big rope around the neck of a public water service.
All right, as you can see what's going on, they're using GATT as a GATT for the against the masses of people. Once again, there's many areas of this. The Democrats are deeply embedded in the whole philosophy of the neoliberal model of expansionists of global capital politics through WTO, GATT, so on and so forth. Kerry voted for it, so on and so forth, when it went through his kitchen. And you have a situation of this is only going to perpetuate war. These are policies of war. These things that are going on are just not some isolated things. These are all of the mechanics of war. In Kenya, when you had a situation where all of a sudden some monkeys, when they saw a water truck coming up to some of the residents, they started attacking the black residents in Kenya. What happened was the monkeys had were starving and were driven mad for lack of water. This all has to do with all of this dam building that's taking place in Africa and India and stuff like that. These unnecessary dams that are drying out riverbeds and lakes and causing eco collapses. And now the animals have gone mad. So here you had a situation where in one of the African magazines, they were talking about how humans and monkeys were going toe-to-toe over the last drop of water. This is how mad this whole economic system is. This whole market capital system is. It's driving not only humans mad, but other species.
You know what? This capitalist drive, you know, like, here's how it kind of unfolds in the United States. Most of the scientists in the United States work for either the government, the military, or on the universities. Now, here's how the corruption plays itself out. Now, check this out. 34% of the lead authors of articles in scientific journals are compromised by their sources of funding. So in other words, now it's becoming acceptable to have these conflict of interests and to be claiming that you're a scientist. But it gets worse. Only 16% of scientific journals have a policy on conflicts of interest. And only 0.5% of the papers published have authors who disclose such conflicts. British and U.S. scientists are putting their names, this is another point, to papers that they themselves have not written, which are instead ghosted by writers working for various companies. And then a last indicator of where we're going with this right now in this juncture of history, 87% of the scientists writing clinical guidelines have financial ties to drug companies. See, that money greases the skids.
Look, there's been a call for, amongst other things, to restore the watershed quality, you know, where it's necessary all over. have separate stormwater and sewage systems, because, you know, having them connected is, you know, and then deal with the problem of runoff from farms, feedlots, and logging and development sites. Thousands of beaches are closed every year because of inadequately treated sewage, and 40% of our waterways are not even safe to swim in. Now, this is, you know, now, this is what they're doing in this country.
Rich.
And now, you know what they're doing throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
What the ramifications of this are going to be. When you had a number of scientists come out against the Bush administration and, you know, all of these Nobel laureates and stuff like that, and sign, you know, a statement about how Boy George and them and their madcap scientists is basically undermining the scientific integrity of the studying that they're doing, and they're putting it in making, you know, deals with all of these coal industries, utility industries, America's largest mercury dischargers. The EPA sat for 9 months on a report exposing the catastrophic impact of children's health on mercury while this whole process is going on. So even when the science gets out, you know, before they make the scientists break the scientists or send them packing, they just sit on it and ignore it. This is all part of the whole economic order. And the reason why they can get away with this is because of the lack of class combativeness in the masses of people. Now, to sum this up, Next Barlow sums up what is needed for the fight ahead. So check this out.
Water belongs to the earth and all species and must not be privatized for profit. No one has the right to expropriate it for profit. We have to protect the world's water supply as a public commons.
Which basically means that if we are going to have a future, capitalism has to go. Hold on a second. Now, to go into another eco destroyer, human destroyer, mental destroyer, and your body destroyer, I'm about to blast into a commentary on an old McShameless McDonald's. Hold on a sec. McShameless McDonald's McLibel Case Blues. Now, there's a McShameless Corporation you can see on the TV every day. I said, there's a McShameless Corporation who, if you're driving down a Mac American highway, you can see one of their Shameless Mac billboards on display. And if you live in America, more than 50% of you, a McDonald's is only a 3-minute drive away. Yeah, I said, if you live in Britain and are involved in telling the truth about old capitalist McDonald's corporations, you may find yourself slapped with a McLibel suit someday. Because after all, Mac's oppressing the working class in America and throughout the world is definitely the Mac, old Ronald McDonald, good old way. Now, This MacLibel case basically got blasting off when a $26 billion a year turnover corporation filed a libel lawsuit in 1986 on five members of the London Greenpeace after years of the organization's campaign, which included a fact sheet leaflet called, quote, "What's Wrong with McDonald's?" What they had to show and say was a lot like the facts on McDonald's anti-union, meaning anti-worker stance, to 48% of McDonald's famous quarter pounder being nothing more than water, to the Ronald McDonald propaganda procedures where McDonald's corporations tries to influence kids through the Ronald McDonald happy orange hair clown trick, a gimmick aimed at kids to create a circus-like atmosphere where food is turned into playthings that are nothing more than props, and where questions like, "Does this food provide me with any healthy nutritional value?" are lost in the grease and fat of a Big Mac. Now, McDonald's, who through their Mac Intimidation libel lawsuits efforts has successfully silenced their critics in the past and forced apologies and or retractments from the BBC, UK Guardian, and major British newspapers, closed down the Transnational Info Center, stopped transmission of at least one film on them, and McSilence the play on the corporation. Never mind the fact of the devastating impact McDonald's and other transnational junk food corporations are having on the world's agricultural environmental systems, in where 50 acres every minute are destroyed, and in where much of these rainforests are turned into arenas for cattle grazing, economically imperializing the third world where much of these adventures are taking place. So in the world's poorest country, 36 of the export food to the U.S. McMarkets are faced with these types of realities that are a part of the capitalist financial system that creates, promotes, and must maintain this type of network McDonald's seeks to protect itself and its image from. Thus, we have the September 21st, 1990 McLibel suit. Of the five persons from the London Greenpeace who were originally hit with this suit, only two, Dave Morris, an unemployed postman, and Helen Steele, a part-time bartender, refused to retract or apologize for the McDonald fact sheet that their organization released. This refusal to submit to corporate dominance got them sent off the battle against Ronald in the British court system, a court system that says the burden of proof is on the defendant. Morse and Steele, in this case, had to prove that everything claimed in their fact sheet was true. Morse and Steele being common working people with meager money and absent the aid of public defense systems in Britain, were faced with the task of taking on the billion-dollar corporation, who had a legal team being paid £6,500 a day, led by corporate hitman £2,000 a day libel lawyer Richard Rampton. Overall, McDonald's spent $16 million in the case. Morrison still had no legal aid and no jury to appeal to, since Rampton convinced the judge that instead of 6 weeks, the trial would last only 4 weeks. If the judge ruled on the trial instead of a jury, the trial lasted almost 2 years. Morrison still didn't even have enough money to buy the same day transcripts. Nevertheless, Steele and Morris' team have been causing McDonald's all kinds of McFits, like the former McDonald worker who made the company sound like McDenny's restaurants, with statements by the witnesses that McDonald's was racist, anti-gay, anti-trade union, with loose cannon managers constantly competing to reduce staffing. But some of the greatest efforts by Steele and Morris was against McDonald's own witnesses, like McDonald's cancer expert witness, Dr. Sidney Arnett. When the Greenpeace team read Arnett a quote from their fact sheet about a diet high in fat, sugar, animal product, amongst other things, being linked with cancer, Dr. Sidney Arnett told, unlike McDonald's, the truth.
For example, McDonald's is suing us for saying that a high fat, low fiber diet is linked to heart disease and cancer. And during the course of the trial, we asked McDonald's expert on cancer what he thought of the following statement, which is: a diet high in fat, sugar, animal products and salt, and low in fiber, vitamins and minerals is linked with cancer of the breast and bowel and heart disease. And he actually said about that statement, he said that if it was being directed to the public, then I would say it's a very reasonable thing to say. And that was actually a direct quote from the London Greenpeace factory, which McDonald's was suing us over. So it was quite an admission to gain from their own expert witness. And really, we think this just highlights the fact that McDonald's are really abusing the laws of this country in order to silence and intimidate their critics.
Along with that, some of McDonald's statements have been somewhat silly, like on the question of nutrition, where McDonald's brags that every time you eat McDonald's, you'll eat good, nutritious food. But as Helen Steele explains, McDonald's is stretching the facts at Macbeth.
They continually promote their food as nutritious. And when we asked their executives what they meant by nutritious when they claimed that, they said that basically it meant provides nutrients and can be part of a healthy, balanced diet. For example, you know, David Green, who's the Senior Vice President of Marketing in the USA for McDonald's Corporation, admitted that that could also apply to a packet of sweets. And, you know, we then went on to ask him about if Coca-Cola could be described as nutritious. And he replied that, quote, it is providing water, and I think that's a part of a balanced diet.
So not to be out-buffooned by David Green, who is the Senior Vice President of U.S. Mac Markets, Dan Fujita, who is the President of McDonald's Japan, gave pseudo-nutritional scientist types of analysis that made one believe that he too may believe that a spaceship was following the Hale-Bopp comet when Fujita stated in court that, quote, the reason Japanese people are so short and have yellow skin is because they have eaten nothing but fish and rice for 2,000 years. If we eat McDonald's hamburgers and potatoes for 1,000 years, we will become taller, our skin will become white, and our hair blonde, unquote. It's obvious that old Dan Fujita has eaten too many Big Macs. But it appears that there'll be no more Big Macs for Ronald himself, played by actor Jeffrey Gugliani, who played the role of the clown in the 1980s, but now educates kids on the degradations of junk food. Quote, I brainwash youngsters into doing wrong, states Gugliano in court. I want to say sorry to children everywhere for selling out to concerns who make millions murdering animals, unquote. And murdering animals is one of the things that McDonald's does best, like cows. 14% by volume are turned into feed for other animals, including other cows. Mad cow disease by design. Along with those realities that these animals live in, horrifying subspecies, unnatural bloody conditions, or even McDonald's couldn't deny that, quote, cattle become frantic as they watch the animals before them in the killing line being prodded, beaten, electrocuted, and knifed, unquote. The meat packers that supplies hamburger meat to McDonald's UK, David Walker of McKee Foods, couldn't deny these horrible facts, commenting, quote, as a result of the meat industry, the suffering of animals is inevitable, unquote. And the suffering of people who eat McDonald's food is also inevitable, as three persons in two separate cases are suing McDonald's and McKee Foods for the infection of food poisoning bug bacteria in the E. coli 0157 case, where three kids eating at McDonald's have been infected. But not only is McDonald's infecting kids, but also the rainforest in places like Brazil, where McDonald's has denied that it has used cattle-reared deforested rainforest land, and McDonald's has claimed to not use beef outside of the European Union. This being in response to the Greenpeace's fact sheet stating that of the devastating effect of the deforestation in the Amazonia, quote, where there are now about 100,000 beef ranches. Torrential rains sweep through the timeless valleys, eroding the land and washing away the soil. The bare earth, baked by the tropical sun, becomes useless for agriculture. It has been estimated that this destruction causes at least one species of animals, plant, or insect to become extinct every few hours, unquote. Also, these areas support about half of the Earth's life forms that produce a crucial supply of the Earth's oxygen, but according initially to McDonald's, they were innocent of the rainforest deforestation until the realities of the Big Mac's deadly grease came squirting right into their faces.
McDonald's was forced to admit that that in the 1980s they had imported Brazilian beef into the UK for use in the company's stores over here, and you know, they frequently denied any responsibility for destruction of rainforests, and you know, loudly proclaimed that they couldn't possibly be responsible because they have a policy of buying all products locally. And when we questioned one of McDonald's vice presidents on how these Brazilian imports squared with this so-called policy, he said that although the ingredients hadn't been bought locally, the hamburgers themselves had been manufactured locally, and therefore it wasn't against the policy. So, you know, it's just like another example of corporate speak, really. Completely meaningless. And I mean, more recently, towards the end of the trial, McDonald's finally gave us details about where they sourced their beef for their Brazilian outlets. And it was quite fortunate we got it the day before our last witness on this subject went into the witness box. And as it turned out, she'd been in those very areas where McDonald's was now getting its beef for Brazil. She'd been in those very areas about 20 years ago when they were covered with rainforests, and then she'd been back recently and they were now, you know, they'd been largely destroyed for cattle ranching. So there's been some incredible evidence coming out in the trials that has really nailed once and for all the McDonald's lie that they've got no responsibility whatsoever for the destruction of rainforests.
And in an effort to show that they have no McShame, McDonald's has been caught sending in its McSpies from two defective detective agencies, King Investigation Bureau and Bishop, with at least seven undercover agents who helped infiltrate the London Greenpeace group. And when Sid Nicholson, stated from the McDonald's UK vice president hit the stand under cross-examination, Nicholson admitted that the company's agents had stolen letters sent to the London Greenpeace from around the world, and that four spies remained in the group after writs were served on the defendants. One of the Mac agents even had a sexual relationship with one of the Greenpeace activists. Mac Nicholson also admitted that McDonald's gained information on the activists by the police from the special branch for 5 years, and on October 16th, World Day of Action Against McDonald's, two of the Mac cops were in attendance, one of whom stood with Nicholson handing out their Cointel-like pro versus the Black Panther and Earth First information on the Greenpeace activists, proving once again that the purest role of the police is to protect and serve the interests of those like the McShameless, McCapitalist, McDonald corporations of the world. So from McFaking at their recycling program to McEvaporating the environment, to McTerrorizing animals, to McSuppressing workers, to McPoisoning kids both mentally and physically, to McShamelessly trying its best to suppress the truth about its true-to-form corporate capitalist operations proving that their slogan, "You deserve a break today," really means that for the best interests of the working people, animals, insects, planets, and environment that the world needs and deserves for its own preservation, a break from the McDonaldization of the planet now. Because we're surely, and they're surely, causing enough Mech Blues on this earth. This has been Tracy James for the commentary. The Mech Shameless McDonald's McLibel Case Blues. Out.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making the Plain News. Government admits investigation against indie media and Petros initiated by U.S. intelligence. The scandal is unfolding in gigantic proportions, and we can hardly keep up with the developments. Responding to a publicity and solidarity campaign by indie media, the government of the Republic of Cyprus has been forced to admit that they were acting under orders from the U.S. government to carry out an intelligence investigation of indie media and of one of its founding members, Petros Ivadakis, in order to assess whether he, quote, constitutes a threat to U.S. interests. After a series of government lies and denials about the case collapse, members of the parliament, the ruling party, and member parties of the ruling coalition were drawn into the public dialogue and shamed into taking a position on the issue. The Union of Editors, the most influential institution of establishment journalism, issued a rare and scathing critique of the way the affair is being handled, demanding an investigation and response from the government. And now the Minister of Justice and Public Order has been shamed into issuing a written statement admitting to the facts, including a directive to the police in polite words, which are equivalent to "get back on the leash," instructing them how to handle issues revolving around the right of free expression. So Sam then put his ugly hand all over the world, as you are well aware, our listeners. And now, right here in Oakland, we're going to have Slave Mart, or Walmart, whatever they call it. They certainly going to need a slave revolt, because they just moved in. Oakland creates big corporation welfare payoff to bring Walmart to Oakland without any community input, and the community is fighting back. Don't let it be here but for a minute. But when they open it, I will apply for a job. 16-year-old East Oakland resident Miguel Giejo pushed his way forward with his ghetto fabulous fro. And then he spoke over the grinding traffic sounds emanating from the nearby Hagenberger Road. That's where they're going to put it, out there by the airport. Now, what's the problem? Why are we tripping about this? Well, as we have already reported here on Slave Revolt, these people were forcing their workers to work overtime without pay. They're famous for this. They were sued and lost the case for $50 million. And now they're coming to Oakland. And I sincerely hope we give them the warmest of greetings. Organize Walmart now. And lastly, Y'all know there's a movie out there. We're going to break into our little phase of the program called Breaking in the Movies. And breaking in is exactly what we're doing. There's a movie out there called iRobot with my man Will in there. Oh, Will Smith plays the role of a policeman who is very highly suspicious of robots. What begins happening is this giant corporation, reminded me of Microsoft, is coming out with this new line of robots. Now, they got these robots hooked up where they obedient, and they got these little rules, the robot will never hurt nobody. Well, they got rules here, too, about the police supposed to be protecting and serving. Nevertheless, what begins to happen is we notice a new line of robots, not quite so obedient, showing up. And eventually what happens is the machines have organized their proverbial takeover of irresponsible mankind. It's actually a pretty engaging film. So we're going to give it one fist up. Y'all going out there and check it. So that's going to be all right now from the Making It Plain news service. Y'all have a nice weekend.
That just about wraps it up for Slave tonight. It's clear that with the privatization of water to the McDonaldization of the planet, that it's time for a takeover. And only then will the slaves truly say that yes, it's time for some true living. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.